This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
My panelists can chime in, but what I thought I'd do is just start with a little bit of background, and then we can have some general discussion. Essentially the engine that is fueling the current problem is technological innovation, and technological innovation is good. The problem is that technological innovation sometimes creates what economists call a short-term equilibrium. I'm completely confident that once we get over this short-term disequilibrium, everything will be fine. And in 20 years, this will all sort itself out.
Are you saying the fundamentals of the economy are strong?
No, I'm not saying that.
Not the American workout, right?
Essentially, since the 1930s, one of the things we've been able to do, originally through Fannie Mae, is allow consumers, it can be home buyers, but it's also people who use credit cards, people who get student loans or whatever, find people at low cost who have money to lend. And essentially what you want to do in any kind of financial system is you want to make it easy for those who want to borrow and for whom borrowing is a good thing, and those who want to lend to find each other. And over the last 15 years, we've developed a terrific way of doing this. And this is, again, very, very oversimplified, through a process of asset securitization, which works in the following way. You find 10 people with houses. The houses are worth 100. They borrow a certain amount. Just to keep things easy, though, this is also part of the problem. They borrow 100 to pay for the house. They promise to pay the money back. These promises and the houses themselves that are collateral for the promises are transferred to a special purpose vehicle that is an entity that holds these mortgages. This entity, in turn, will issue new securities that are backed by this bundle of mortgages that are inside the special purpose vehicle. You will have another entity over here, which is another special purpose vehicle, and this special purpose vehicle will buy these securities and will create, buy both from this special purpose vehicle and other special purpose vehicles that also hold these bundles of home mortgages or bundles of different kinds of assets. It could be a collection of credit card receivables. And this special purpose vehicle will have a diversified portfolio of these promises. Now, everybody understands that not all these people are going to pay the money back in full. It's very risky, but if you calculate it correctly, the interest rate that's being paid fully compensates for the risk. Okay. The particular magic that happens at this point is you put all these assets into a pool, and then you write new securities based on the special purpose vehicle, but what you do is you create different tranches, different levels of seniority. And so you will take, let's say, the top level, let's say it's the top third, and what the people who get, and you'll issue a security that's essentially the first third of all the assets that ever flow to the special purpose vehicle. Okay. What is the particular magic of that? The particular magic of that is that the only way the first third of these promises won't be paid is if two-thirds of these people fail to pay, and you end up realizing zero on the collateral. The chances of that happening are basically zero. It's almost inconceivable we could have two-thirds of home values being lost, two-thirds of the people never paying the money back, and the underlying collateral being worthless. Even during the height of the Great Depression, default rates on loans were still in the 90%. So, you issue these securities for the most senior tranche, and you sell this to various people in the world. And the particular magic of this is these securities, even though they're based upon very risky debt, turn out to be virtually risk-free, assuming you've made all the calculations correctly. And in addition to that, so what you're able to do is you're able to find a bank in Germany that is willing to loan to someone in Peoria because you've created these bundles of securities and you've divided up these tranches in ways that make them extremely safe. Indeed, this kind of security is so attractive that what was commonly done with this vehicle, which is called, which issued what are called collateralized debt obligations, these were so attractive that the people who organized these special purpose vehicles would, in addition to buying these actual mortgages, would buy synthetic securities that whose financial properties mirrored the performance of this bundle. In other words, imagine this is essentially a bet. These securities are essentially a bet that the houses will prove to be worth more than 100 or less than 100. So what you have here is a collection not only of promises backed up by collateral, but synthetic securities whose performance will mimic this. These are called credit default swaps. And you can think of it as a kind of insurance, depending upon whether or not you're the buyer or the seller of this insurance. But what you have are these various vehicles, and these various vehicles have securities that, in theory, if you believe the underlying models, are incredibly safe. And the given the market conditions and everything else, these securities are replicated and amplified by these credit default swaps. Okay. In terms of what went wrong is, again, without looking too soon, is that these models didn't turn out to be completely correct. Okay. And for a variety of reasons that people don't completely understand. But at every stage, if you make a tiny mistake, it turns out to be very bad because the people who ended up buying these securities tended to be very leveraged. And by virtue of being very leveraged, it meant that even if they make a small mistake, and they think that something is AAA, and it's not AAA, it's not bad, it's not garbage, it's not junk, but it's not AAA, you can get into a lot of trouble very quickly. At any rate, the current situation we have is we have this dynamic, we produce these securities are incredibly hard to value. And once people discovered that the ratings and the way in which they valued these assets turned out to be unreliable, the market for these things disappeared. And so what you have are a lot of people holding on to these incredibly complicated instruments, and no one is willing to buy them because they don't have any ready means of valuing them. And again, it's a little bit like a Lemons problem. If I have a really, really complicated security, and I'm not holding on to it, but I'm selling it to you, you have some reason to believe that the reason I'm selling you this security as opposed to some other security is because it's a limit. And if you're not able to value it, you're going to be very reluctant to buy it. And in the limit, this market can disappear. So we have this new technology. This technology that allows you to bundle and pool risk and connect borrowers with creditors is in principle very good, but it is not very well understood. These transactions were highly leveraged. These instruments are very complicated, and it was exacerbated. The problem was exacerbated in two respects. First, there was a conscious governmental effort that's been in place since the 1930s, but accelerated during the 1990s, to encourage marginal buyers, lower middle income people, to buy their own homes. Hence, riskier loans were made, more risky than they would be otherwise. In addition, the people buying these securities in this country, various financial institutions, became, over the last couple of years, much more highly leveraged. So the nightmare scenario that you have is you can have a bank that, let's say, was, instead of having a 12-to-1 capital ratio, let's say it's a bank that just had a 10-to-1 capital ratio because it's being incredibly conservative. Okay? And let's assume that this bank said, we don't want to have anything to do with subprime at all. The only thing we're going to do are get these securities that are based on a diversified portfolio of senior loans given to really, really solid companies. If you bought that security a year and a half ago, you would get an interest rate of LIBOR of plus 25. That same security today is LIBOR plus, don't hold me to these numbers, I think it's like 325. The effect of that
is... I think it's even higher.
Maybe even higher, but that's not the point, okay? Even at these numbers, this security that you bought at 100 a year and a half ago is now trading at 80. Even though there's no subprime mortgages, even though these firms are basically, it's just a little bit riskier, it's a little bit harder, and that means the security you bought for 100 is trading for 80. Okay, now, you could say, well, why don't you just suck it in, okay? You've lost 20%. The difficulty is if you have a 10-to-1 leverage ratio, that means that you started off with having assets of 10 and a liability of 90. Now you have a liability of 90 and an asset of 80. And again, the dark side of the world that we're living in is that that's a set of numbers for somebody who's done everything right. And so the frightening situation we're in now is that it's possible. Again, we don't know what pieces of paper these financial institutions actually have, but you can run through some models in which you have a financial institution that's done everything that's exactly right, and it appears that institution now is broke. And that's what is upsetting.
Okay, so let me just add a couple comments and then I'll add a macroeconomic element to this. And since Douglas drew, I'm going to draw two.
So there's this country called China. So we're over here, and then there's this place called China. Here we are. And we like things that are made in China, like tainted milk and plastic toys. So we send them, you know, $500 billion in cash, actual dollar bills, every month.
Don't hold me to these numbers, roughly.
China has this money. They get it. What can they do with it? Well, they can't give it out to their citizens, because what are they going to do with dollars? You can't buy things in China with dollars. They've got to invest it. Well, this is a nice thing. They got to invest something with dollars. Well, what are they going to invest it in? Well, it's going to come back to us. Okay? It's going to come back to us in investments. Well, what can they invest in? Let's say they have three choices. Let's say there's only three things in the world. The one is the U.S. government. The other one is houses. And then let's say Google. Google has now taken over and they own everything in the United States in terms of producing products. So now China can invest in one of these three things. Historically, they invested in the U.S. government, something called treasury bills. The government would sell these bills. China would give us $500 billion, and that's how we pay for, No Child Left Behind. And killing people in Iraq. That's what we do with that money. The problem was, after 9/11, Greenspan lowered interest rates. So the interest rate to borrow money went to, nearly zero. This was a loose monetary policy, inflationary credit policy. That is, money's very cheap. Okay, this is what got us into the problem in the first place. And it's funny now we're lowering interest rates to get ourselves out of the problem, which is kind of funny because we're trying to solve a problem with what got us into the problem in the first place. Okay, China doesn't want to invest $500 billion in something that's going to give them a 1% return. They could invest in Google, and Google, I don't know, it's 100% return over the last, couple years. They could invest in Google, but it's risky. This is the future of China. So they don't trust Sergey and whatever that guy's name is. They could use the $500 billion to buy, the Portland Trailblazers, and what good would that be for China? So this is risky, but a big return. This is not so risky, we thought, but a very low return. But what about this one? Houses. Okay, someone comes to them and says, look, you can invest in U.S. houses and let all of us buy houses, and the return on these things, because of what Douglas has suggested, is, 10, 15%. And wink, wink, this is Uncle Sam winking at China. This thing, Fannie Mae, is backed by the government, right? If it fails, the government will bail you out. That is, China becomes basically a bondholder of Fannie Mae, and we'll bail them out, which is exactly what we did. So you have a situation where you have an implicit promise from the U.S. government that they can invest in these securities and earn returns that are higher than what they should be, because they're not bearing the full risk. What does that mean? That means this money gets funneled to right here, to houses. Okay? That means, so that's bad government policy. That is social engineering gone awry, this pressure to push people into houses. What's so good about home ownership? It doesn't make any sense. Okay? So the entire social policy, from the mortgage interest deduction to encouraging subprime lending, is terrible. Okay? But that coupled, and you know, bad government policies exist, they're everywhere. But the real problem becomes when you add bad government policy with the natural greed of humans. The natural greed of humans is always there and always in the background, but when bad government policy gets on top of it, hold on to your wallets, right? It is fire and fuel, and we've seen this innumerably in U.S. history. The greed of people who can make money based on these implicit government promises is what we've seen is enormous. As a consequence, we had huge investment in this country in houses that turned out to be not worth so much. And you had people who took real equity out of their houses and bought things like plasma TVs and flipped houses, and that stuff just is not worth what it appeared to be. Okay, so we had bad government policy coupled with the natural greed of people who were investors. All of us, anybody in here who watched Flip That House, anybody in here who ever thought they could invest in a condo with no money down, right? All the mortgage brokers who were cheating and scamming people and making $85,000 a month, and these people did exist during the boom times. And now we have to, you know, figure out what we're going to do with these huge overinvestment in houses. One option, and then I'll shut up. One option would be to just let all the banks fail. Use the bankruptcy code. There would be lots of work for Douglas, which would be a good thing for the law school. Let the U.S. government fail, for that matter, right? And we might see this entire welfare structure, which is you know, a house of cards, just like the housing bubble, come down and have a real reckoning. But that would be really painful, right? That's cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria, terrible. The harm would be enormous. Like, you know, it's the air under the curve. The harm would be very, very, very bad. We might come back up, or we could sort of try to preserve the bleeding. That we may drag it out like we did in the New Deal, but it may be a little easier for all of us. I think the reason that the bailout that I'm sort of, you know, feel like the government has to do something, it's because we don't live in a world where everybody takes their reckoning and people are punished for their bad mistakes. And we just don't live in this hypothetical world. There are real social consequences for letting people fall, letting people out of their houses. The human cost could be enormous. So it reminds me of Milton Friedman, who at a dinner party at my house, although it was before I lived here and many years ago, but it was in my living room and I now love, was ranting against rent control. And, you know, a little old lady from Hyde Park came up to him and said, "Milton, are you really going to throw these people out of their house?" And he said, "No, of course not, right? This is, in theory, we should try to do away with rent control, but we can't. We're stuck in the world that we're in, and I think we're stuck in the world we're in." And the reason that I think the government wants to bail out Wall Street as opposed to letting these banks fail and new banks arise to connect lenders with borrowers is because we need money from China, right? China's not investing. We need them to invest. And if Goldman Sachs and Bank of America fail, China's not going to lend, give money to the Baird and Henderson Bank to give to people, right? The reputations and potential costs of that are too high for them. So the $700 billion is a way of sort of, you know, there's a bridge between borrowers and lenders, and our bridges have holes in them. We could build new bridges, but it may take us a while to get there to the point where people would feel comfortable crossing those bridges again. So this is us repairing these broken bridges in an attempt to sort of salvage and make the human misery here a little less. I think, sadly, the consequences, though, for short-term benefits are potentially long-term gain, but we can talk more about that, and then I'll shut up.
So thanks to the Federal Society for convening us here. This is obviously a crucial topic. I want to begin with a story heard when I was a law student in your shoes. So there was a story about a law professor named Tony Cronman, who was recently married. His wife, or this is, I think, at the time of his marriage, his bride-to-be is going to get a haircut, and she comes back, and the haircut's been botched. And so he goes to the beauty parlor, and then sort of destroys things in the beauty parlor to express his dismay. And so then, of course, the police are called, and he's taken to prison. And the story that's told is that then he gets on the phone with his Yale Law professor colleagues and asks them to bail him out. And they all, in turn, say they don't know how to do it. Right. And so my point here is going to be that I think it's important for lawyers to know something about bailouts. Right. Which is exactly what us academics often are not very good at, as you can tell. So what are some reasons that we might be important? That is, I think it's crucial that this is a subject discussed here, not just across the midway of the B School, right? The expertise that's at the B School is not enough to get us out of this mess. And that's what I'm going to argue. So what are some basic issues that we have here? Well, first, there's a principal-agent problem. And that, of course, is the problem that the people who have the assets, who own something, don't have the same incentive as the people who actually run the companies, who make the decisions. Okay, on a day-to-day basis, right? The disconnect between the incentives and the interests of the principal and agent are something that we lawyers actually know a lot about. And we have common law and a corporate governance structure that is designed to address this problem. And this is a serious problem here, because what you had was not only China, but also private bankers, people on Wall Street, people in Chicago at hedge funds, making decisions with not actually being the proprietors of the assets that they were dealing in, but rather getting enormous profits on a short-term basis. So that is, you could make, like Fold did, a quarter of $1 billion over the last handful of years, and not necessarily be the one who had the same, and watch then the value of Lehman go to zero, right? The CEO of Lehman, of course, something like half of that compensation was in the form of options, and that, of course, is designed to resolve at least or ameliorate the principal agency problem. But we lawyers are the ones who think about that problem, I think, and think about that problem in a way, how to structure long-term relationships that can address that problem. Right. So I think that's crucial. A second important aspect of this is the notion of moral hazard. Again, the notion that the people who actually are undertaking the activities may not bear the risks of that activity. Right. And so we lawyers are the people who design structures to deal with moral hazard. How do we make sure that people don't make such foolish moves in the future, right? Have to internalize the risk, not externalize it to all of us, not just rely upon us to bail them out. Third, there's an international nature of this, and Todd adverted to it with the mention of China. But financiers don't really care about borders, right? They only care about where money flows, where the rates of return are. But the regulatory structures are national in scope. There's only coordination, promises, hopes with respect to international governments. Just today or last night, the United States rejected the proposal of the European Union that we agree to back up interbank lending right? So the Europeans said, we should all guarantee, get together and guarantee interbank lending, which principally occurs in London. The United States said, no, we will not guarantee interbank lending. So those are issues that lawyers are particularly adept at, thinking about who governs, where the law is, who needs to be held responsible in these kinds of situations. A final reason that we want to be thinking about these things is that we are often asked to resolve these problems. So first, who created these innovative structures in the first instance, right? It was bankers working with accountants, working with lawyers. We were very much a part of that three-legged stool. And so when these structures were created, these enormous structures, we couldn't simply say, I think, we shouldn't simply say as Barney Frank, as no, Tom Harkin says about listening to Alan Greenspan, it says in today's paper, he was able to say things in a way that made people not want to question him on anything, like he knew it all. He was the oracle, right? And so one of the crucial things is, as you are a practitioner, not just take the words of the bankers as kind of oracular statements, not susceptible to your human understanding, right? So it's crucial to press people on the nature of the legal structures that are being created, to not just simply pass it off to the bankers, the wiser bankers, who actually know what they're doing, we're told, right? Finally, as I said, we might be the ones called upon to solve these problems. Well, it turns out that Barack Obama, for example, is a lawyer. And he may well be the one who's called upon to solve this problem, right? I shouldn't use the word one, the one. Yes, he may well be the person. Robert Rubin, who solved these crises for the last decade, is a lawyer. Right? He's not he became a banker, but his legal training is as a lawyer. I mean, his educational training, I should say, is as a lawyer. So these are the crucial players in many of these instances are actually lawyers. And so we lawyers cannot simply let the issue go to someone else's hands. And I'm happy to see that you are all here to think about these things.
So one of the things that we were told that we were going to do a lunch format, a bit like our own lunches at Roundtable, and I will assure you that we actually sit down when we talk to each other normally. But I think how you frame the problem of the bailout has a big impact on what you think the solution is. And so I don't purport to have a very good, theory, certainly no better than, a lot of other people about what caused it, but I think that I want to add something to what Professor Henderson and Professor Baird have said in particular, and a little bit to Professor Turner, because I think they tilt the answer by framing the problem the way they do, in a way that I think there's at least one piece of the puzzle missing. So Professor Baird basically told you that if the people who price these things, so some guys at Standard & Poor's were just a bit smarter and a bit more careful, we would not have this problem, right? And Professor Chanda said, well, actually it's, that they have moral, that, the bankers have moral hazard, and maybe the guys at Standard & Poor's, there's also a kind of, who are they really serving? Who's their master? Are they doing it right? If the master is the people, then, there's a moral hazard problem. So one view of Professor Baird and Professor Chanda's diagnosis is, we just need more University of Chicago law students to work at Standard & Poor's, smarter people. Or we need better, align the incentives of those guys better. So that's one part of the puzzle, right? Professor Henderson's diagnosis is, I think, in many ways, very compelling, but he tells us the China story in combination with it's what happens when you have bad government policy hooked up with, greed on Wall Street, right? And the prescription then is, well, it's hard to figure out whether, how we're ever going to prevent bad policy again. So the solution is, don't let government get hooked up with the private sector and have public policy solutions, which are public-private partnerships, which, combine those things. That seems troubling to me as a general prescription, and I think it has a very strong tilt in the future towards a much more limited form of government intervention, regardless of your substantive preferences around a particular set of policy domains. And Professor Henderson, when he's not talking to his base, has been willing to admit to me that, you know, maybe there was some good policy there and some bad policy. Good policy might be allowing really poor people who wouldn't otherwise have homes to get a very concrete and relatively small transfer to allow them to have a home. And what was the really bad policy was allowing people who did not live in those homes, who were not really poor people, to get access to Fannie and Freddie funds in order to have second, third condo investments, which they weren't going to be able to repay. So I think that we need to highlight that what caused the bad policy, not the hookup between, quote, bad policy and the private sector, if, you know, we want to see the full range of solutions, and certainly the solutions that I'm predisposed to want to see it as the answer. That, to me, raises the question of why did we end up with such bad housing policy? And part of the story is about transparency, right? Professor Henderson, I'm borrowing his idea here in our previous discussions, which is, you know, this was a form of subsidy that was completely hidden to the American people, right? No one went to the polling stations in 2000, in 1990 for that matter, saying, oh, you know, I'm really worried about housing subsidies and, you know, which candidate is more or less of pro-housing subsidies, because it was totally not on the public radar. And that this was a form of extremely covert, extremely non-transparent public policy, and that can have very damaging consequences. And there's another way in which I think transparency and poor oversight or poor regulation might have played a role in the story, and therefore we might think that regulation is part of the solution, or at least a bigger part than the difficulty of valuation and the hookup between the public and private. And that is in thinking about how these banks got so levered, and how the interconnection of credit default swaps basically got us into the position, which is investment banks like hedge funds, like private equity, have very, very few disclosure requirements, almost none in the case of hedge funds and private equity. They often disclose very little voluntarily, and so that it was extremely hard for people to figure out how levered they were and how much they were using these extremely risky assets that had been misvalued, right, as part of their capital assets that were then being re-leveraged. So no one was really figuring out what they were doing in a way that made the market unable to price their assets appropriately or to, you know, deal with them in an appropriate counterparty way, and certainly no other form of oversight. And that links into the general consensus is that these banks were too levered, right? They were borrowing at something like 30 to 1, and the commercial bank leverage is more like 8 to 10. So now that Goldman has reconverted itself into commercial bank structure, it's bound by that, and it's also bound by transparency requirements. And I think that that will mean that some of this mispricing is more likely to come out, the market's more likely to punish it earlier on, and so that it doesn't spread through the economy in this way, where people re-borrow or re-leverage bad pricing to begin with. So I think that, to me, that there's a, it's important to ask us, you know, I'm sure Professor Bed and Professor Henderson are going to tell me why he's characterised the position, but to realise there's some connection between how we characterise the problem and what we think the solution is. There's probably lots of causes, but which ones you subscribe to means that, you know, you'll have a different view. Having said that, I think that there isn't a perfect correlation, right? It may be that lowering interest rates post 9/11 helped cause this problem, but it's still the right thing to do now to lower interest rates to try and correct the economy. It may be that we put too much money into housing to begin with, which is what caused the problem, but it's still now the right thing to put more money into housing to try and solve this problem, which is effectively what the bailout is doing. And it may be that moral hazard, as Professor Chan said, helped cause the problem, and the bailout itself creates more moral hazard problems for sure, right? Because it tells people that if they take risky behaviour, they may be bailed out or insured ex post. But that may still be the right thing to do. So that there's a weird tracking. There's definitely a correlation, but it's certainly not a perfect one, because maybe there's no perfect theory for all time, particularly in a world of massive global connection and contagion and an expectations game. And the last thought is, you know, I think this area is an area which, across partisan divides, you would say it's really hard for people to figure out good and versus bad trading. And both sides of politics are most likely going to say things which don't acknowledge that, right? Which is, part of the point is securitization and credit default swaps have created massive wealth in this country. There's an article in the front page of the New York Times today that says, oh, you know, the problem is that Greenspan had too much of a belief in derivatives. Derivatives are an enormously helpful and important instrument for hedging, right? But as Professor Baird said, that insurance is an extremely positive thing from the perspective of welfare enhancing. But once you have derivative markets of the kind that we've been talking about, you can get massive speculation. Speculation itself can be good because it can create liquidity for hedging, but it can also be bad, right? It can mean that tiny, tiny perturbations in the market can have massive flow-on effects. And so part of the struggle I think this crisis raises is good trading, bad trading, you know, they both happen, and is there ever a way of sorting them out that doesn't crush the good trading through regulation, or just allow, in the name of good trading, massive speculation to make us extremely vulnerable to these kinds of crises?
Again, speaking as a bankruptcy lawyer, I did talk about this as background, but I'm much more interested in how we fix the problem we've got now rather than the philosophies that might have gotten us into this mess. The other thing I would say is I think all of you are being wildly optimistic about the condition we currently find ourselves in. We haven't talked really about the bailout or what it's supposed to do, what problem it's supposed to fix, or whether or not we think it's going to work. I'm extremely skeptical. I don't know exactly. I don't even know, as of this morning, what exactly this bailout authorized. I mean, it seems that Paulson is taking the position that he's allowed to invest in equity in banks, which is very hard to get out of the statute. You should remember, it is actually a statute. One of the things we do as lawyers is we understand, you know, we look at the statute, we look at the words in the statute, we try to figure out what it means. Senator McCain suggested that this statute authorizes the direct purchase of home mortgages, which, again, I don't see from the language of the statute, but
although we may get there, I mean, that if you buy up all the pieces here, you just reconstruct backwards, and you end up owning houses.
Not in a million years. I mean, there's so many. The problem with these CDOs is they're so complicated that it's very hard if you have a CDO to know what house you got a mortgage in or what sliver that you have a mortgage in. A lot of these CDOs, they don't just have home mortgages, they also have credit cards and other kinds of securities. The other
which I think just is important to this now sounds more like lunch, right? To Rosalind's point about, I agree with a lot of the things she said, although being accused of being in favor of massive wealth distribution is not something I usually find myself being accused of. That being said, so she said transparency is an important thing that regulators can do, and I couldn't agree more. I think then pointing at, and I'm sorry I'm looking backwards, but I think just thinking about going forward, pointing to hedge funds and private equity funds is, I think, the wrong place to point. Because the problem here wasn't transparency, because Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and Bank of America and all the people who were involved in this are the most heavily regulated entities on the planet. And they had made full disclosures to everybody.
And also, just so you get a sense of the bad news, Lehman Brothers didn't own any subprime mortgages. It was only commercial real estate that brought them down.
So, and they made all these disclosures.
So you solved all the subprime mortgage problems. You wouldn't have helped Lehman Brothers.
Yeah. Okay. So the transparency problem was that a lot of these credit default swaps, and now take your mind back a year ago, they were being traded, and they were so valuable and so exciting to people, and they were just basically money printing factories, that they were literally, the contracts were literally handwritten on pieces of paper, on scraps of paper, and they were just sort of stored in file cabinets. And there was no, like, New York Stock Exchange, where there were prices on computers and people could see what they were. There was no transparency in that sense. And people were just so busy selling them that they never really thought, well, let's actually go and, you know, have some sort of record keeping. So that contributed to the fact that no one knew what anybody owed. Well, the private sector realized that this was a problem. A trade group formed. They met in London. They included some people from the government. And they said, okay, we're going to clean up our act because we realize we're not doing a very good job. But the private sector alone, every individual firm might not have the incentives to invest sufficiently in this program, even though we would all benefit. So it's just classic collective action problem, classic kind of commons problem, and a place where government can actually serve a very important role. So I couldn't agree more about the transparency and whatever. I just think it's a little bit misdirected towards hedge funds, which, you know, the problems here were the regulated guys. Hedge funds are going to fail, but, you know, rich people are going to lose their money in those things. And I think it's just there's less chance that those are scams. And I'm not sure we need more regulation of that kind.
So I'm a little bit more optimistic than Douglas, I think. And I think if you look at the history of these financial crises, one of the important things to remember is that the analog here is not the Great Depression, which was, you know, a long time
before.
Well, the best analog, I think, are the Mexican peso crisis, the Asian financial crisis, things that are much closer to hand, things that actually, which reflect a very similar kind of problem, which is confidence in the markets evaporates 100%. No one is willing to lend to anyone else because they don't know whether they'll get the money back. Right, so that is the nature of the Asian financial crisis and the Mexican peso crisis in 1994. Those are much more recent historical events, and those show us, I think, that eventually, if with sound management, that things come back. And they don't necessarily take a lost decade, which is the hope, right? And so Mexico returned, its economy returned. I mean, lots of people were harmed dramatically during that time. And the Asians who are visiting us for the year will have lived through the Asian financial crisis. But they will have seen, of course, that things did ultimately improve. So I think that the other important aspect of that claim is that the crucial, so I'm not saying it's entirely, I'm not saying it's not the at all relevant, but the Great Depression. But the fact is that we have now internationalization of finance in a way that that we've never seen before. And that requires us then to come up with international legal structures, international financial structures that can overcome these kind of confidence problems in the markets.
Yeah. Well, again, let's assume that you're completely right. Okay. And let's assume that the only problem we have right now is just a liquidity problem. You have all these securities. These securities really are worth something, and people are just unwilling to trade them. One way you can justify the current bailout program is it's not really a bailout problem at all. What we have is we have a market in which things aren't being traded. And once confidence is restored and people start trading things again, it may be these things don't trade for as much as we hope. They don't trade for 100, but they trade for 60. And what the government is able to do by having well-designed auctions, and let's assume they can set up these reverse auctions so they work perfectly, and let's assume that these come into play very quickly, and that when we have these auctions that come into play, we again can establish values for these securities, and the markets will return, and we'll all be happy. Okay, that's the best case scenario for the government bailout program. It's not really spending $700 billion. It's doing what it did in the case of Chrysler or other entities, where it's just providing liquidity, or what happened in long-term capital management, you know, where it wasn't insolvent. You're providing liquidity. It's okay. Assume that happens. And assume you can conduct these auctions, and I'll explain in a second why you can't. But assume that all that happens, and assume that these government bureaucrats can do all this incredibly well. That's the best possible scenario, but you still have to confront the fact that the securitization market has died. A huge source of capital that we've been relying on and living on, that we've been enjoying, that's been largely responsible for prosperity for the last decade, has disappeared, and nobody's suggesting it's coming back. It's one of the things that's happened is we've opened up a drawer that we thought had money in it, and it's not there. Okay, so I agree with you. It is possible, I'm being pessimistic, it's possible this bailout program will work, and it's possible that we are simply back in the situation we were 10 years ago, and we're just trillions of dollars poorer than we thought.
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, it's like we disinvented the automobile or the computer.
We've lost a piece of technology. Securitization was an incredibly valuable piece of technology that you relied on. You relied on to buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks. You relied on your student loans. You relied on to buy your houses, buy your cars, and it's gone.
I mean, if we found out tomorrow that everybody who used a computer, for those of you using computers now, be careful, right? You get brain cancer automatically when you look at computer screens, and we just got rid of all computers.
It's not terrible. I used to live in a world where we didn't have computers, and it's okay. But you know.
Let me just say one thing, and then to Rosalind's point, and then let Rosalind have a chance to talk. So she said that this thing about not voting on this. I mean, what I've called this is a bail in versus a bail out. We're basically, if let's put aside these sort of disinventing derivatives, and the New York Times is doing its job to make it even worse this morning. We basically say, let's say it's going to cost us $1 trillion to bail out just housing, okay? And we feel like bailing out housing will then have these cascading effects. I'm pessimistic, as Baird is as well. I don't think it will, but let's just say we do that. We're spending $1 trillion.
It's not enough.
Okay, so my numbers are wrong, but okay, worse. Several trillion dollars. So basically, that's just a wealth transfer from taxpayers now to people who bought houses, right? The Cook County Sheriff is not going to foreclose on people. People who didn't put any money down, who have no business living in the houses they're living in, are going to live in their houses. They're going to have those assets. The government might come in and write down the principal amount of. I hope Paulson shows up at my front door tomorrow and tells me my principal amounts that I owe Bank of America are a lot less than they should be because I overpaid for my house. Come on, pity. Oh. So I hope that happens. So it's just a massive wealth transfer to people to buy houses. Well, we could have had a vote in 1996.
That's not entirely fair. It's not a wealth transfer just to the people who bought the houses. It's also a wealth transfer to the sleazeballs who sold them.
This is where I was going. I was going to say the same thing. That is, we could have had a vote in 1990 that said, we want to invest in houses. The government's going to build houses, and they're going to rent them or sell them or be the mortgagor for people who are poor. That would be where we are now, but we wouldn't have had Fold making $200 million on this. We wouldn't have had mortgage brokers who didn't go to college making $85,000 a month. We could have had the social policy, that is this wealth transfer, and it's less than the amount that we're going to pay for it now. But it's politically impossible to vote for a bail-in for $1 trillion for houses, even though the net after the fact might be better. And one of the reasons why is because we weren't sure that this was going to collapse. And when Barney Frank said, I want to roll the dice on housing, that's exactly what he meant. There's some possibility that the crisis will happen, and if the crisis happens, then it's real easy to mobilize political support for a bailout, because although the sky's falling, it's much more difficult to do it as a bail-in. But the bail-in would have been more efficient, to Baird's point, that is, there wouldn't have been sleazeball people making hundreds of millions of dollars.
So I want to turn a question back to Professor Baird and Professor Chan. You know, should we be deeply pessimistic or deeply optimistic? So the bailout doesn't seem to have worked as hoped right in the last week, which is the hope was get this through Congress, everyone would sigh, you know, markets would hold steady, and that certainly the drop post congressional passage has been a disappointment to those who thought that it was going to at least stem the tide.
I don't think anyone thought it was going to stem the tide.
Some people did.
I think that's not. I think the cynics were very, very.
No, I think there are a lot of people who thought that it wasn't going to work, but the consequences of doing nothing would be even worse.
Okay, so I had four options, and let's see. So one is that, you know, it wasn't big enough, would be why. So let's just say that there is some degree of relative to expectations that things have done worse in the last week than, you know, some people might have hoped or expected. Can dispute the premise, but let's say that that's right. What should we infer from that, right? One is it wasn't big enough. The second is it wasn't global enough. The third is that the delay was critical for expectations, which is, you know, the whole suspending campaigns, negotiating, you know, the Democrats playing politics, the Republicans wanting to add terms. You know, the delay was crucial. The fourth is we drove too hard a bargain. The whole point is to inject liquidity, right?
And no. I said, he's making that assumption. He's making the assumption that what we have is a liquidity problem. And that was the best case scenario.
Sure.
I mean,
you don't want to go there, right?
No. Basically, until you know what the problem is, it's very hard to discuss solutions. And we haven't really identified the problem. I don't know what it is these banks are holding. I don't know what those instruments look like. I don't know the distribution of these credit default swaps. I don't know exactly what the various risks are. I mean, the fear with AIG, for example, is they're long on too many of these credit default swaps. Just to give you just a sense of the dollar amounts involved here, fortunately, the amount of credit default swaps outstanding has dropped dramatically over the last year. So the total outstanding credit default swaps we have now is only $52 trillion.
You're scaring the poor guy. I want to put one small footnote to that. I mean, a lot of that is zero sum. A lot of those are bets.
I understand. Red and black, they cancel each other out. I understand that.
I understand, but if we have a $100 bet, the notional amount on that is $100,
right.
And one of us will have $100 at the end.
Right.
It's not like we burned $100.
Right.
So there's a part of it which is just wealth transfer. So there's a lot of people right now who bet short. They went short. They thought houses were a bad investment, and they're rolling the dough. We haven't heard from them. I don't know where they are. But please, if you're listening to this podcast, please send your money to the people who need it. I just went to Costco and dropped a grand. I need it. And the deadweight loss component is what we should really be worried about, not the people in the zero-sum game.
The deadweight loss component has already happened.
Well, we don't know the extent of it, but anyway.
And option five is, I think, where you've been going, which is, you know, we don't know what the problem is, and this is either just tangential or there is no solution. So, you know, if they're the five diagnoses, I guess it's a harder case for Professor Chander than...
I am not misunderstood. Caricaturing my position. I'm not saying it's simply a liquidity crisis. It is certainly a liquidity crisis as the credit markets, which have seized up for perfectly healthy corporations, which can't turn around and borrow in the capital markets. It's a crisis for them, not because of their economic fundamentals are sound, except that the credit markets behind them aren't able to provide them with the liquidity they need at this moment, right? But there, of course, there's a solvency crisis for financial institutions that have overextended themselves, made bets through these leveraged derivatives that were bad bets, right? The bets are not worth, those institutions are not worth what they owe, right? So that you will have bankruptcies, you will have...
I don't think you understand the problem. I mean, there's possibility that only some banks are insolvent.
Right. So Professor Baird is suggesting that the banking system entirely, or 90% of it, or something like that, is insolvent. Right. So that's the
worst case scenario is virtually every bank in the world is currently insolvent. Okay. That's not just a liquidity problem.
I didn't ever suggest that it was just a liquidity problem, so let me just make sure.
I'm not saying, because this is being recorded, I want to make sure. Yeah. I'm not saying for sure that every bank in the world is insolvent. I'm just saying that's the worst case scenario.
But that's right, then why hasn't the Fed extending, you know, its willingness to be, you know, insurer of last resort helped correct the...
It hasn't done that.
Because going from a leverage ratio of 30 to 1 to 10 to 1 is bigger than all the assets of the United States government.
So
that deleveraging problem is enormous and not clear that what the government can do can help. And the government, since this is a federal society event, I'll say two bad things about the government. The government has done a couple of things that are just making the problem worse. So a bailout, a promise to buy assets. So if there's a liquidity problem and I'm holding an asset that no one will buy, or someone will buy but they'll pay me $10 and I just paid $100 for it, and I think that someday the government might pay me $50, well, then I'm not going to sell it for 10, take my lumps, write off the losses, and move on. I'm going to hold out and wait until the government might give me more. So there's every day that the government delays, you can't expect the markets to unfreeze themselves if there's a government bailout possibility that they might buy an asset from you. That's one problem. The second problem
is... We're going to have to let Rosalind say something eventually.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I want a word count on that. Quickly, the other one. being in the middle of the political season, bad, and the reaction in even in places like the SEC, which is, you know, generally they're not idiots, they suspended short selling because they blamed this on speculators. We saw this before in the PCORA hearings and the weeks fall of the Great Depression and the crash. Speculators were not to blame then, and they're not to blame now. They stop short selling, which just makes everybody lose money. There's convertible bond markets that rely on short selling. Hedge funds rely on short selling for all kinds of reasons, have nothing to do with speculating. And all those investors were unable to make the investments they wanted to make because they couldn't short sell. And that, again, you know, talk about the Dow going down 600 points, contributes to the problem. So policymaking, when in fear, is going to lead to bad results. I'll shut up.
I think though that goes back to the you can't tell good versus bad trading, right? Which is, this is one of the problems, which is maybe at the juncture we're at, which is we're waiting for 3 weeks to figure out what impact the bailout has, short selling that's purely speculative, bad. But, you know, hedging, good, right? And the problem is the Securities Exchange Commission can't tell the difference. And so I think that part of, I mean, we disagree on this, but I think that there is part of the problem of you just can't target one set of transactions without getting the other.
So Professor Baird began by saying this was, we are here because of a rise in technology, and then he's worried that that technology is going to be forgotten or removed from our toolkit. So I think what's going to happen is that technology is going to be regulated, right? And that's what's going to be crucial to ensuring confidence on a long-term basis. That is, the derivatives market is, one argument you can make is the derivatives market is impossible to regulate, that we don't have the financial, tools to actually do the pricing.
It's an arms race. So we've got some lawyer who never even took corporations who's the regulator. And then we have the PhDs who are creating these securities in real time. Who's going to win that arms race?
And we should remember, just briefly, derivatives were, and you don't agree, I think more regulation is coming. Derivatives arose to get around regulation. There are capital adequacy requirements. Banks have to hold a certain amount by international standards of Basel agreements. In loans, so if I loan out $100, I have to put $8 in cash on the side. In the event there's a crisis like this, I've got money to pay off depositors. They don't like putting $8 away. That $8 isn't earning any money. It's just sitting there in the vault. Derivatives are a way around that. And so derivatives and financial engineering arose to solve a government regulation, get around a government regulation. To Professor Brett's point, whatever regulations we're going to install, the geniuses on Wall Street, quote unquote, are going to come up with ways to try to get around it.
A huge part of it. Let's go ahead, sorry.
Degree of genius, though, there's still, I mean, those banks subject to capital adequacy requirements are still less levered than those institutions that are not, right? So surely geniuses on Wall Street cause bleeding from the regulatory target, but the question is whether they get you as far away as a deregulated or totally unregulated world.
First of all, again, I don't want to sound like a Federalist, and this is actually the first time I've ever been invited by the Federalists to anything.
You can be invited back.
The two things I'd mention is first, to the extent there are problems, you have regulatory capture, which is a relatively familiar story, that's allowed banks to have unbelievably high leverage ratios. That's problem. Problem number two is a large part of the problem, one of the things that was fueling securitization is regulatory arbitrage, that you have lots of government regulations that say you can only buy AAA securities. And so, and that's how we're going to regulate people. We're going to say you can only buy AAA securities. And then, of course, they say, and we're going to see if you can also get very large returns. Well, what happens in that environment is people play the regulatory game. You know, there's Joe at Moody's who rates bonds, and there are these PhDs who figure out how Joe is doing it. And what they do is they create securities that, because of the scoring system, you know, it's like I'm teaching to the test. Because of the scoring system, are rated AAA, even though no one thinks they're AAA, but the people buying them buy them anyway because there's a government regulation that says they have to. And again, that's part of the problem of, again, I don't want to sound like a Federalist, but part of the reason we're in the mess we're in is not an absence of regulation, but the presence of some kinds of regulation.
Or Professor Henderson's story, because Moody's, right, are private. They're private bodies with a government regulation.
Right. They're tied to a government regulation, but the relevant government regulation is the one that says you have to buy stuff that Moody's says, rather, excuse me, not Moody's, but Joe, the guy who does this at Moody's, says is AAA. And also just to emphasize a degree, I think, sort of with what you said, lawyer. It's very well to say what lawyers think about moral hazard. What the lawyers actually do is the lawyers right now are reading these various documents, just trying to figure out, you know, what they do. And indeed, one of the people at Ground Zero is Donald Bernstein, who's a graduate of ours, and he's just trying to put the pieces back together. And it's not very easy. These instruments are incredibly complicated. And just figuring out who gets what and who's holding what is not something that's going to be very easy.
5 minutes.
Sure. Is questions?
Sure. Sure. Sure.
So this I think a lot of questions to ask. There's a lot to cover, but I want to ask you something, Professor Barrett. So, if I remember right, you had a conversation, or there was an event similar to this with a smaller group. It seems like about a year ago, where we talked about subprime. And you were substantially more optimistic then, at least about that narrow slice of the topic. So, I'm not trying to play gotcha. You're certainly entitled to change your opinion. It's a different topic today. But my question is, what's changed? What's made you more pessimistic now than you were then?
In fairness, I was pretty pessimistic back then. And again, I actually, one of the things you do when things like this happen is you go back and see what you missed. My focus, my academic focus has been on what's going to happen with financial innovation and what's that going to do to corporate reorganizations, which is my principal focus. And that's just sort of a small hand grenade that hasn't gone off yet. And when it happens, then that'll put me back to work. But this macro stuff is not generally what I do. I certainly understood that there could be a major problem with these credit default swaps and this counterparty risk. And it's also true that in talking to these guys who were setting up all these instruments, who said they calculated all these risks, I did actually say in print they told me they'd thought about all these problems and worked them out, and they may be right, and then some pigs may fly. Okay, so I understood that coming. What I didn't quite understand. I guess the particular thing I didn't understand, and I've sort of come to realize only recently, is I understood how these garbage tranches might turn out to be a lot worse. What I didn't understand is how these AAA tranches could be as bad as they are. And I didn't understand that the banks were actually holding on to the stuff. I thought what the banks were doing, and indeed one of the problems was the banks were simply operating as pass-throughs. I didn't realize that one way or another these banks were actually getting their hands and retaining this AAA stuff at much higher levels than I thought, and that even the AAA stuff that hasn't become junk is still, in this world of high leverage, become so toxic. So the short answer to your question is I didn't understand the extent to which the banks that are sort of controlling the flow of credit were, I didn't think they were as close to ground zero as they turned out to have been.
So much to me like the credit default swaps that are tied to the price of houses are kind of like a Ponzi scheme for the banks that relies on a perpetual increase in housing prices. Is that completely incorrect?
Yeah, it's not technically a Ponzi scheme. We want to be respectful to the memory of people like Charles Ponzi. Ponzi scheme is a particular kind of con, and this is not, if it's a con, it's not that kind of con. I mean, a Ponzi scheme works by using money from new investors to pay off old investors, and that's not what's happening here.
So, credit default swaps are used in a whole range of areas, and I think Professor Baird is pessimistic about this. We haven't seen lots of companies, small companies, medium-sized companies, large companies, who it turns out, borrowed way beyond what they could possibly do in a normal situation. Now, we may see bankruptcies as a result of the crisis, but corporations didn't lead us to this situation. It was houses. And what was it particular about houses? Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, one of them was a government policy that subsidized this massively. Another was, people who buy houses are easier to prey on, right? Especially if they're lower income people You know, they don't have time, they don't have the education, they don't have the background. So a lot of the, you know, something like 30-40% of these subprimes were just fraudulent. There were people out there that were, you know...
What percentage did you say?
I thought it was something like 40%.
Well, maybe 20.
Okay, so a large percentage. But you had appraisers and you had people basically pushing up on people, loans they didn't understand, for houses they shouldn't have been in, with basically the government's imprimatur. That thing is the contagion which has caused the problem. And it, whether it was premised on, you know, rising housing, I mean, everybody thinks that values of the stock market and houses are going up. And this, you know, derivatives don't kill people or firms. People do. And so, you know, we don't want to do away with derivatives. So when the New York Times writes this on the front page, we should all scream and run and say, no, wrong, right? We need to find out what it was about how we misused derivatives, because risk sharing is a good thing.
Well, at the risk of being Cassandra again, one proposal some people have had from lots of different quarters is ultimately the government should just come in and assume these bad mortgages, convert them to fixed rate mortgages, and just, you know, take the loss and go forward. The difficulty, that we can argue about the merits of doing that. One virtue of doing that, which a number of respectable economists have proposed, is that once you actually stabilize the value of the houses, you you may clear up the problems that are further downstream. But note, simply wanting to do that is very, very hard when you're concerned with a market in which the level of fraud is very high. Because I can't imagine any piece of legislation that's going to say, we'll buy people out for the full amount of their loans, even if they engaged in fraud. Well, if 20% of the people engaged in fraud, how's that going to happen? I should also say, just to give a nod to different practice areas, I am completely confident that a large number of these executives are going to be spending a number of years in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania.
And on that note, thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.